Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. North Korea issues threat to U.S. and South Korea. North Korea today issued a threat of a preemptive nuclear strike as a joint U.S.-South Korean military exercise got underway. It follows tougher U.N. sanctions on Pyongyang after its most recent nuclear test and missile launch. Troy Stangerone of the Korea Economic Institute tells VOA that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has become more belligerent lately.
We've seen a change since Kim Jong-un has come to power. The threats have become more specific and more common.
More than 300,000 South Korean and U.S. troops are engaged in the military exercises around which North Korea often issues threats. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden kicked off a five-day trip to the Middle East on Monday, addressing U.S. airmen stationed in the Al Dhafra Air Force Base near the United Arab Emirates capital of Abu Dhabi. He referred to ISIS by its Arab pejorative, Daesh.
We have to squeeze the heart of Daesh in Iraq and Syria, so they can't continue to pump their poison into the region and the rest of the world. And that's what we're doing with our coalition partners. We're hitting Daesh fighters and leaders harder than ever. We're making it harder for them to maneuver. We're cutting off their lifeline, their oil revenues, and their finances.
He dismissed Islamic State insurgents as criminals and cowards in an interview with the Abu Dhabi newspaper, The National. Mr. Biden pressed the U.S. case for a negotiated peace settlement to end the five-year civil war in Syria, ruling out a military solution. Now, peace talks are set to resume again later on this week in Geneva as a truce has sharply curtailed fighting in recent days. This is VOA News. Police in central Somalia say at least six people, including two African Union soldiers, were injured Monday in an explosion at an airport in the city of Beledweyne. In an interview with VOA Somali, Beledweyne Police Commander Colonel Ali Du Abdi said an explosion occurred at the entrance of the airport while security forces thwarted others. He said the security officials immediately discovered another bomb. Abdi said police arrested 20 suspects in connection with today's explosion. A Taliban suicide bomber has blown himself up outside of a local court compound in northwestern Pakistan, killing at least 13 people and wounding 36 more. A local security official told reporters that police guards identified and intercepted the bomber, but when they tried to grab him, he detonated the bomb. Tunisia's interior ministry said Monday troops killed 21 militants who attacked a police station and military facility near the Libyan border. Officials say at least four civilians and one soldier were also killed in the clashes in a southeastern town. European Union leaders meet with their Turkish counterparts today to discuss efforts to slow the flow of migrants traveling to Europe as thousands remain stranded at the border between Greece and Macedonia. The influx of nearly 1 million people arriving by sea in Greece since the beginning of 2015 has European leaders hoping to persuade Turkey to keep migrants from traveling the dangerous route. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan, the steadfast partner of the 40th U.S. President Ronald Reagan, died yesterday. She was 94. As First Lady, she was Mr. Reagan's closest advisor and always sought to protect him from whom she thought were devious people.
She was tough. But she had to be tough, and I use that term in the very best way. President Reagan was totally guileless. He never met a person he didn't trust or that he didn't like, and that was one of the secrets of his success, his optimism and his enthusiasm.
That was James Baker. He was President Reagan's chief of staff and later served as his Treasury Secretary. President Obama and his wife Michelle said Nancy Reagan redefined the role of First Lady. American Ray Tomlinson, widely credited as the inventor of modern email, has died. He was 74. Mr. Tomlinson invented something called the Direct Electronic Messaging System way back in 1971. Now, that worked between different computer systems and servers. He also chose the at symbol to connect the username with the destination address, and it has now become a cultural icon. From those beginnings nearly half a century ago, the popularity of personal email actually did not become a way of life till about 10 years later. Google's Gmail team on Sunday tweeted, "Thank you, Ray Tomlinson, for inventing email and putting the at sign on the map." Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yves Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
It looks like one of the plans of Islamic State is to make of Benguerdan their first principality, if we can say that, in Tunisia.
That's Mourad Taib reporting from the Tunisia-Libya border on today's attacks on a Tunisian border town by unknown gunmen suspected of being Islamic State. Details coming up.
Also, the humanitarian crisis is getting worse in Ethiopia, and more than 2,000 migrants and refugees arrived on the Greek islands today after crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas and Puga, sitting in for Sunny, music from Ghana and our daily feature, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the humanitarian crisis is getting worse in Ethiopia. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says humanitarian needs have tripled since the beginning of last year because drought has led to repeated crop failures and widespread livestock deaths. The drought is blamed on the effects of a powerful El Nino weather phenomenon. The FAO describes the rates for food insecurity and malnutrition in Ethiopia as alarming. More than 10 million people are now listed as food insecure in one quarter of the country's districts. The UN agency says quick action is needed to help farmers produce enough food between now and September. Planting for Ethiopia's first rainy season, the bulg, has been delayed, and the main agricultural season, the maher, will arrive soon. Many farming families have exhausted their seed reserves, and animal feed stocks are also depleted in many areas. The Food and Agriculture Organization is calling on donors to provide $13 million by the end of this month to support 600,000 of the worst affected people. The amount is part of the FAO's broader appeal of $50 million for its Ethiopia El Nino response plan.
A new study says when it comes to food security and climate change, two key human responses have been overlooked. One is how much land farmers decide to cultivate, and the other is the number of crops they plant. Julian Ramirez-Villegas is a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds in England. He's also lead author of the study and is working with the CGIAR research program on climate change. He says the study identifies where and, more importantly, when interventions need to be made to stop climate change from destroying vital food supplies in Africa. He first spoke with me about why the study was needed.
We realized that there's actually a lot of information about climate change impacts on agriculture, climate change impacts on crop productivity, and most of these studies ask the question of what is likely to happen by, say, 2050 with maize, and what can we do? So we realized that if we asked the question differently, we could frame the problem of adaptation or the issue of adaptation as an issue of temporal scale. So we asked the question of when instead of what. That's what motivated this research, trying to resolve this question of when adaptation needs to happen.
And what did your study find?
We analyzed 9 crops contributing to about 50% of African agricultural production and 60% of the region's produced protein supply. What we found is that 6 out of these 9 crops remain relatively stable in their niches, so the transformational adaptation needs are relatively limited, whereas for 3 out of these 9 crops, and this is maize, beans, and bananas, adaptation needs are much, much more substantial.
In that case, then, what do farmers need to do to improve these particular crops?
There are several adaptation strategies, and the different adaptation strategies need to be implemented at different temporal scales, basically, which is the main point of our paper. What we established is this framework of adaptation whereby we say adaptation should happen at least in 3 overlapping phases. The first phase, we define it as an incremental adaptation phase where agronomy should improve, so there should be an improvement in crop yields of farmers, improvement in livelihoods. Also, there should be some crop breeding in this incremental adaptation adaptation phase, the construction of irrigation facilities, and basically this incremental adaptation phase is aimed at prolonging suitability in the areas of decline. So basically pushing the transformational adaptation times further away in time. The second phase is the preparatory phase. So once you know that there is likely to be a transformational change, you need to prepare. What this phase entails is policies to be modified in support of transformations, transitions in facilities for food storage, transport and processing, and even changes in diets might be needed in that phase. The last phase is the transformational adaptation phase. So specifically in that phase, we see livelihood changes happening. In that case, the clearest example is when you have a farming system which is based on crops and it becomes too risky or unsustainable, then shifting to livestock might be a better option because livestock systems are generally more resilient than crop-based systems. One thing to highlight is also that in the incremental adaptation phase, there might be options that can avoid changes. One good example of that is crop breeding. If you can breed new strains of crops which are tolerant to heat, then the projections of transformational change might not actually be realized because what drives some of these transformations is that climate is too warm to grow a certain crop.
Do African farmers have the resources to make these changes?
That's difficult to answer because it's very context specific. What we see in sub-Saharan Africa is that most of the systems are subsistence farming systems, which is relatively food insecure, for example. It is really difficult to think that that type of farmer will have the resources to adapt. So there needs to be support from policies and institutions for these types of farmers. But we also know that there are better off farmers in sub-Saharan Africa. So in those cases, you can expect those to be responding, to kind of have the resources to respond by themselves.
Julian Ramirez Villegas is with the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds in England. He spoke with me from Colombia, South America.
More than 2,000 migrants and refugees arrived on the Greek islands today after crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey. Nearly 1,000 arrived on the island of Lesbos alone. Reuters news agency reports the new arrivals followed a deadly boat accident yesterday in which at least 18 people died. Meanwhile, in Brussels today, EU and Turkish leaders held an emergency meeting to try to stem the flow of refugees. Tens of thousands of migrants and refugees remain stranded in Greece, unable to travel further due to closed borders. In fact, the Balkan route from Greece to Germany is expected to be officially closed. Those stranded at the Greek-Macedonian border had already been looking for alternate routes to Germany. EU leaders are also expected to offer more aid to Greece to help house the migrants.
There's also word today that Hungary and Croatia will reopen three railway border crossings that have been closed for nearly a year. However, there's no word just when they'll reopen or how long they'll remain open. The railway crossings had been a main route to Germany until Hungary built a fence along its borders with Serbia and Croatia. Meanwhile, in France, as the government continues to raise the migrant camp near Calais, known as the Jungle, a new migrant camp has opened in the north near Dunkirk. AFP says the $3.5 million camp, built by Doctors Without Borders and local officials, meets international standards. It features 200 heated cabins, toilets, and showers. The medical aids group expects the camp to eventually have 375 cabins. AFP says the French government had been opposed to the camp.
Armed gunmen attacked a police station in the Tunisian town of Ben Groden this morning. It's the latest in a series of attacks along the nation's border with Libya. Some believe the attackers were trained in Libya and may be affiliated with the Islamic State group. Reporter Murad Tayyib has been reporting on the border conflict for several weeks and talked to VOA's David Arnold about recent events.
Early in the morning, at about the dawn prayer, at 4:30 in the morning, a group of gunmen attacked some neighborhoods and special houses in Ben Groden, this town near the Libyan border. Apparently, the armed group, presumably Daesh militants, attacked police officers and customs officers and army officers, they already know, and they already know where their houses are. So they attack, they know their targets. Around 6:45, they killed a customs officer and his three-year-old girl in one of the streets of Bengerdan.
The Associated Press says that 26 people died, and most of them were attackers, but one policeman and several civilians. Is that correct?
The latest official release from the Interior Ministry says that about 10 armed officers, police and army officers, died in the attack. 6 to 10 civilians died too, and 27 Islamic State militants were killed in these clashes. About 15 Tunisians, civilians and police and army officers, and 27 Islamic State militants were killed in the clashes.
Is there confirmation of the identity of the attackers?
70% or 80% of those killed or captured are originally inhabitants of Bengerdan. And most of these militants are apparently coming from Sabratha. They fled Sabratha after the United States strike on the 19th of February, and they fled Sabratha to come to Tunisia.
What is the significance of this town and this border region between Libya and Tunisia?
Seeing this big number of Bengerdan kids who were among the attackers, it looks like Islamic State, after because they can no longer be in Sabratha, it looks like they were planning to launch or to create a principality for them in Bengerdan. That is, it looks like one of the plans of Islamic State is to make of Bengerdan their first principality, if we can say that, in Tunisia.
That's reporter Murad Tayyib. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold from the Tunisia-Libya border.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiyas Wahib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The humanitarian crisis is getting worse in Ethiopia, and more than 2,000 migrants and refugees arrived on the Greek islands today after crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new Harvard University study predicts a serious funding shortfall in HIV prevention and treatment in sub-Saharan Africa over the next 35 years. The study warns that domestic and international funding is not keeping pace with population growth and new infections. According to the research, more than $260 billion will be needed by 2050, given current trends. Dr. Rafid Atun is the lead author of the Harvard study. From London, he spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
We estimated funding required for HIV prevention and treatment in 9 sub-Saharan African countries with the highest burden of HIV at the moment, which include South Africa, Nigeria, Zambia, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Uganda, Ethiopia, and Malawi. Our study is the first of its kind in looking at funding requirements between 2015 now to 2050, 35 years into the future. And you might ask, why did we choose to project into such a long period of time? And the reason for that is because now with antiretroviral treatment, AIDS has essentially become a chronic illness. most people receiving antiretroviral treatment will continue to live well into the future. So we really wanted to estimate what the funding requirements would be into the future as the number of people receiving antiretroviral treatment continue to live and as new people are added to the number of people receiving treatment.
And what did you find?
Well, we found very interesting and somewhat worrying numbers. We found that if we were to maintain the current coverage levels into 2050, we would require $98 billion in the countries that were studied. That's obviously a very large number. This is at the current coverage levels, but that doesn't scale up treatment. And with the new guidelines, we should treat everyone who is HIV positive. And if we were to do that, then the obligations would increase to $261 billion.
Why is this worrying per se? I mean, one would think that the funding would increase proportionally as time goes on to meet the new demands.
Funding comes from two sources, essentially. Domestic sources and international sources. Most of the countries we studied, there's not enough funding from domestic sources to meet current and future obligations. So they're highly dependent on international financing. Of course, one of the big concerns is that donor funding is not increasing. So therefore, we need to ensure two things. First of all, funding from domestic sources needs to increase, but the funding from international sources also needs to increase. The bottom line is that the AIDS epidemic really is not over. And we need to ensure that the fight against HIV continues so that we can sustain the gains that we've been able to achieve, which has been quite remarkable so far. But the fight is not over.
Dr. Rafid Atun is a professor of global health systems at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips from London.
With anxiety growing over the economic slowdown in China and global financial uncertainty, African countries are scouting for new ways to transform their economies. Experts say regional integration and favorable trade agreements between African nations continue to be critical to the process. University of Geneva professor Marcelo Orianga is director of Research Network on Trade and Labor Market Outcomes in Developing Countries. VOA's reporter Ruben Chama asked him, given the current economic situation, what are African governments doing right and what are they doing wrong?
I think that what they're doing right is that most African governments have engaged in a process of trade liberalization over the last 20 years, both at the multilateral level, at the World Trade Organization, for example, but also at the regional level. And regionalist process has been very vibrant in the region with a lot of agreements. And that's the right step. So, because you are opening up to bigger markets where there are bigger opportunities for African firms. There are two problems that I think African governments are not addressing very well. The first one has to do with the implementation of those agreements. There is a lack of credibility and implementation of what is agreed. For example, in terms of factor mobility between the East African community, it's very difficult for a formal worker from Uganda to come to work to Tanzania. There are some exceptions, but it's still very difficult, and whatever agreements have been signed are not being very well implemented. And I think sometimes the regionalists and the trade policy in the region has made big commitments that it hasn't been able to deliver. And that harms the credibility of the government and the effects of the policy. If you're not credible, the policy can have the opposite impact of the one you are expecting. Another area where I think African governments lacking is on policies that, when you do these trade reforms, as our research in the network shows, sometimes unemployment can increase. Sometimes informality can increase. And that doesn't mean that the trade reform is necessarily bad for the economy. For the economy as a whole, the reform is good. The problem is that there are some people suffering. And there are people that are going to lose their job, they're going to lose their formal job, and some of these people can be very close to the poverty line. You need these retraining policies that help workers acquire new skills that are going to be useful in the new sectors where there is a big demand.
Is trade actually benefiting the average African? Does it create jobs or does it reduce the job opportunities?
I think it's very difficult to give a general statement about that. Our research has shown that in countries like Ethiopia, trade has been a promoter of jobs. In countries such as Kenya, the trade reforms have had very little impact in terms of job creation. In countries like Brazil, trade reforms had had a negative impact. The reason why trade may lead to a loss of jobs, two main reasons. The first one has to do with mobility of workers from one industry to another. And in some countries, those mobility costs to move from the agriculture, let's say, to the manufacturing sector can be very costly because the training programs are not there and the workers would need to spend often more than a year's salary to retrain and acquire the skills that are necessary on the other side. So there is a need for the governments to step up and put in place training programs that when you open up to trade in the manufacturing sector, that it allows workers to move to agriculture or food processing sectors in which the country has a comparative advantage. So the retraining of workers is something that can help go from a trade reforms that reduce jobs to a trade reform that allows those workers that are negatively affected to move to the sectors where there is more demand and higher productivity. The other important aspect that the research in the network shows will matter is, again, when you open up to trade, you are moving workers from one sector to another. But in some sectors, the labor market has more frictions. There is more unemployment. Why there is more unemployment? Well, maybe there is more collective bargaining that leads to very high wages. Maybe there is stronger labor unions. Maybe there are problems of information. The match between workers and employers is more difficult. If you are in the agriculture where you only need very low skilled workers, then the match is very easy because you just need the workers to do basic stuff. But if you are moving into food processing and you need engineers and you need technicians, information that you need to do the matching between employers and employees is a little bit more difficult.
That was trade expert Marcelo Olariaga from the University of Geneva speaking with VOA's Ruben Chama in Nairobi, Kenya. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehisu Heeb in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Let's talk. Television and music. Do they really have great influence on our lives? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing the influence of television and music. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews, analysis, We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The humanitarian crisis is getting worse in Ethiopia. And more than 2,000 migrants and refugees arrived on the Greek islands today after crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey. Coming up, we'll have some music, and in our feature segment, in Kenya, 16 million people lack access to safe drinking water. I'm Kim Lewis with Mahias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young this weekend. What's on tap today, Douglas?
Well, thank you, Kim. We're starting off in Zurich, Switzerland.
Okay.
Thank you very much. That's where the second edition of the FIFA Women's Football and Leadership Conference is taking place at the FIFA headquarters. A statement from FIFA says the conference, entitled Equality Through Reform, brings together a wide range of voices from sports and wider society to discuss ways in which women's football and women in football can be further promoted, particularly in light of FIFA's recent reforms. New FIFA President Gianni Infantino, Abe Wambach, Christine Hetero, Sunil Gulati, and tennis legend Billie Jean King are among the high-profile figures who will be speaking. A short while ago, Samoa former Football Federation CEO Sarai Berman, who is the only female on the FIFA reform committee, explained how to turn policy into action.
Personally, I think it needs to be a two-pronged approach. It has to happen from the top down. Mm. We're talking about from FIFA level through the new council, down through the confederations, but it also needs to come from the bottom up. And this is where the grassroots comes into it. This is where, you know, the women who are out there every day and men at the member associations, on the ground level, in the activities, part of the development, running the competitions, it has to come from that level too. And it's important that there is some education and communication that goes down to that level to let them know what has happened. Mm. I mean, I was really surprised in the Women's Leadership Conference in Amsterdam a few days ago that there were some women in the room who weren't aware about the reforms that had passed and what had been done at that level. So the communication all the way down through the chain to the bottom, it's got to happen.
In his opening remarks, new FIFA president Gianni Infantino reiterated the important role women can play in football administration.
I firmly believe that women are part of the solution. And that's why I'm also happy that this conference takes place here today, because it shows where we want to go. It shows that we can speak about things, which is already, I think, quite a big progress. Mm-hmm. It shows that we can speak about this in a very open way, and it shows that we can move things and we can make things happen in reality, because this goes also to the top-down approach, but also to the bottom-up approach, to the education, to the discussion, to the bringing to everyone this message and try to convince everyone to make the things happen.
The conference coincides with the annual celebration of International Women's Day, which takes place Tuesday, March 8th, and provides an annual focal point for women in sports and leadership. It also forms part of FIFA's commitment to promote, develop, and invest in women's football so that the sport and those who play it can grow to their full potential across the world.
Visit VOA's website at www.voanews.com. You can read in-depth reports from VOA correspondents around the world. You can also download audio and video files and play them on your computer or portable MP3 player. www.voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is the sunny side of sports. Now for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma. Mark begins with rugby.
South Africa beat hosts United States of America 21-10 in the bronze medal playoff at the IRB 7 Series in Las Vegas, Nevada State on Sunday. Japan beat Kenya 19-14 in the semifinal of the plate category. Turning to football, hosts Zambia outplayed Namibia 3-1 in the 2016 Women's Africa Cup of Nations qualifier in Lusaka on Sunday. Algeria pipped their visitors Ethiopia by a solitary goal in Algiers. On Saturday, hosts Botswana went on the rampage, beating Mauritius 7-0 in Lobatse, some 70 kilometers south of the capital, Gaborone. Burkina Faso and Tunisia drew 0-0 in Ouagadougou, as did Mali and Morocco in Bamako. Senegal edged Guinea 1-0 in Dakar. Earlier on Friday, Zimbabwe came from behind to edge hosts Tanzania 2-1 in Dar es Salaam. In athletics, Lucas Rotich clocked 2 hours 9 minutes and 11 seconds to win the Lake Biwa Marathon in Japan on Sunday. Third-placed Tanzanian Alphonse Simba was 8 seconds behind Rotich. In cycling, Lithuanian Thomas Vaitkas won the Tour of Oran, some 420 kilometers west of the Algerian capital Algiers on Saturday. Algeria's Saidi Nassim was second ahead of Eritrea's Tesfom Okumba Mariam. This is the second stage in the Grand Tour of Algeria, where cyclists stand to gain valuable points to qualify for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. In disability sports, hosts Algeria prevailed in both the men's and women's contest at the Africa Gold Ball Championship in Algiers on Saturday. Algeria outclassed Egypt 7-2 in the men's final, while Morocco dismissed Tunisia 14-4 in the bronze medal playoff. Earlier on, Algeria beat Egypt 11-1 to win the women's contest as Morocco placed third. Consequently, Algeria qualified for the men's and women's gold ball event at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Paralympics.
That was Mark Omar reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark. Now, in athletics, Olympic 1500 meters silver medalist Gamze Bulut has been provisionally suspended from pending an IAAF investigation into a possible doping violation. Turkey's NTV television reports that abnormalities were found in Bulut's blood samples from 2011, 2012, and 2013. The 23-year-old is the fifth 2012 Olympic finalist to face drug allegations, along with fellow Turk Asli Katil Apletekin. Apletekin has since been stripped of her gold medal and banned for 8 years. Natalia Kareva of Belarus and Russian athlete Yekaterina Kostekaskaya, who finished 7th and 9th respectively, have since been banned by the IAAF for biological passport abnormalities. Ethiopian-born Swede Abebe Aragawi, who finished 5th in London, was suspended last week pending an investigation after testing positive for a banned substance. Meanwhile, there have been changes to the IAAF gold label races. Rabat will become the first African city to host a Diamond League meeting later this year, but New York has been dropped from the calendar. The Moroccan capital will host this season's third meeting on May 22nd. IAAF President Lord Coy said in a statement that the General Assembly of the Diamond League meeting in Zurich, Switzerland, has decided to include Rabat, Morocco, as a new host city for the prestigious global series of one-day athletics meetings. Rabat replaces New York with immediate effect for the 2016 season. The U.S. retains one Diamond League meeting in Eugene, Oregon. Morocco has previously hosted other IAAF events, including the 2014 Intercontinental Cup in Marrakech. Now, the 2016 IAAF Diamond League calendar stands as follows. It kicks off in Doha, Qatar on May 6th, moves to Shanghai, China on May 14th, on 22nd May to be Rabat, Morocco, May 28th is Eugene, USA. Then Rome, Italy hosts this on June 2nd. Birmingham, Great Britain is on June 5th. Also Norway is on June 9th. Stockholm, Sweden will be June 16th. Monaco will be on July 15th. And then the London Marathon in Great Britain will be on 22nd to 23rd July. Lausanne in Switzerland follows on August 25th. Paris, France will be August 27th. Then Zurich, Switzerland will be on September 1st and then conclude in Brussels, Belgium on September 9th.
Still in athletics, Kenyan David Rudisha on Saturday began the Olympic year with a win in the 800 meters at the IAAF World Challenge meeting in Melbourne. In his first outing for 2016, Rudisha clocked 1.44.78. 20-year-old Australian Luke Matthews chased Rudisha all the way home to smash his personal best by more than a second. Matthews' 1.45.16 was his first time under the Olympic qualifying standard. Rudisha and Matthews were the standouts of a meeting traditionally strong on middle distance, but there were also impressive performances from Ryan Gregson in winning the 1500 meters and Madeline Hills in the women's steeplechase.
What's better than the sunny side of sports? More sunny side of sports. Listen to our new expanded show now on VOA Africa.
In boxing, Lucas Brownie stopped defending champion Rashan Chagayev in the 10th round to win the WBA heavyweight title in Russia. The Australian, who is managed by Rick Hutton, was knocked down in the 6th round, but floored Uzbekistan's Chagayev with a big right. Brownie, who improves his record 24 wins with no defeat, followed up with a series of right hooks before the referee intervened. Britain's Tyson Fury is considered the WBA's heavyweight super champion, as he also holds the WBO version. In Birmingham, London's Bradley Skitty won a unanimous points decision to take the British and Commonwealth welterweight title from Sam Eggington.
Yes, this is Sunnyside Sports. Now for what's trending on social media, we turn to Andrew Pelecheski. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Douglas. Good to be with you.
Good to be. So what's going on right now? What's trending?
Well, the world is about to mark International Women's Day on March 8th, and that is no exception for the sports world. They're also marking it, in particular FIFA. You know, Gianni Infantino, the new president of FIFA, speaking out, sharing comments. He says, we have to embrace equality, speaking about equality, gender equality in athletics. And so a lot of people are talking about this on social media. You have people using hashtag women in FIFA to talk about this issue and to share Infantino's comments and their hopes. A lot of people saying, let's hope he follows through on his words with actions. They'd really like to see this equality message carry through and actually be carried out. Another thing I saw in social media trending I thought was very interesting about this was a photo of Abby Wambach, who is a member of the U.S. Women's National Team, very famous female soccer player here in the U.S., and Billie Jean King, who, of course, is a female pioneer in athletics, great tennis champion. Mm-hmm. They were both at this conference, so they shared a photo together saying, we're fighting for women's equality in sports across all sports. And a lot of people sharing that photo and saying, what a great message and what a great way to mark International Women's Day.
And especially that, Andrew, that the women have had a lot of road deals as far as FIFA is concerned.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's something that a lot of people are focusing on, saying that FIFA in particular is an organization that can do a lot of good to change this. Of course, you have men's soccer and women's soccer on the World Cup stage. So they said that this is a great opportunity. Many sports are focused solely on men. For example, in the National Football League here in the U.S. is predominantly a male sport. But FIFA is one that they have men and women. So they said this is a great opportunity for FIFA to do some real good here on gender equality.
And quite a good timing, too.
Yes.
Because tomorrow is Women's Day.
Absolutely. I'm sure that's no coincidence. I'm sure that it's a concerted effort on the behalf of FIFA to make this an issue, to bring this out in light of International Women's Day. And certainly people are picking up on it on social media.
So apart from FIFA and women's soccer, what else is trending?
Well, the big story here in the United States is Peyton Manning, of course, the famous National Football League quarterback, set to announce his retirement today after 18 seasons in the National Football League. People noting it's interesting his number is 18 that he wears. So number 18 after 18 seasons, it's very fitting, they're saying. Of course, he's the second quarterback ever to beat every team in the National Football League. The only other is the very famous Brett Favre, which I'm sure our listeners will know that name, perhaps one of the most famous, if not the most famous quarterback in the National Football League. And there's a lot of speculation on social media about what Peyton Manning will do next. Will he be a coach? Will he work for the National Football League in some capacity? Could he end up owning a team maybe one day? He's made a lot of money off of his good play on the field, so maybe he could be a partial owner of a team. Mm-hmm. But a lot of just excitement. Congratulations for him. Of course, he was a quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts and the Denver Broncos, won Super Bowls with each of those teams. So fans from both of those teams are celebrating his legacy on social media.
And he has not, has not let out what he may intend to do after this, after retiring.
No, a lot of speculation on social media. A lot of people joking that the first thing he's going to do after he retires is just take a nap and relax for a little while. He was the oldest quarterback to win a Super Bowl at 39 years of age. So they're saying so some jokes about his age, but they're saying that he should maybe just take some time and relax and enjoy being retired. It's rare that we can retire at such a young age. Oh. So the fact that he's retiring at 39 is one of the most famous sportsmen in the U.S. and arguably in the world, and a very wealthy one. They said that he should enjoy that for a little while, and then we'll see. Maybe he'll be a coach of some capacity or something like that. Maybe he can win some more Super Bowls yet. We'll see.
And again, 39, Andrew, in sports is a very, very old age.
Yes, it is. So, but congratulations to him on a great career.
Well, thanks, Andrew. Andrew will be back again on Wednesday for sports topics that are trending on social media. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas, and listen to Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Douglas will have an expanded half-hour edition of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up in Kenya, 16 million people access to safe drinking water. They don't have it. But first, some music. Here is Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher, Higher.
Because of your policies, the world thinks they we within a diamond and gold. Precious metals or they bribe and line your pockets with our cash.
Self-hatred for one another.
There'll be no growth till we discover
how to eliminate the enemy.
We've always been oppressed in captivity.
Let our family use us.
Countrymen slave us
and make deals with white men to trade.
God will save us.
Cause
we've lost our identity.
No sense is beyond.
We're drowning in disloyalty.
The leaders that we've had so far.
Cameroon's Deborah Debs with Africa Higher Higher.
In Kenya, 16 million people lack access to safe drinking water and 60% of rural folks remain off the water grid. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Kenya's Kajiado province on an initiative that enlists local women to try to fill the gap.
Kajiado gets little rainfall. The Kenyan capital, Nairobi, is 125 miles away from Esther Kuma's homestead. The mother of nine has to buy 10 jerry cans of water a day from local businessmen. Even then, she says, the water isn't always safe to drink.
We have to go as far as 10 kilometers to reach water since there are no rivers around. That's why we're forced to buy water. When we hear of anyone selling water, we have no choice but to buy.
Coca-Cola has been setting up eco centers around East Africa since 2014 to provide safe drinking water. The centers get water through boreholes. They use solar power and a purification technology called reverse osmosis. Cabinet Secretary for Water and Irrigation, Eugene Wamalwa, says misappropriation of funds in his ministry has kept so many rural Kenyans off the state water grid.
I've told them in no uncertain terms there will be no sacred cows, and coming into a ministry that was one of those affected by the cleanup that His Excellency the President led, we have said we are not going to go back to the ways of the past, the ways of corruption.
The county digs public boreholes, but residents must still trek many kilometers to reach them. This newly opened eco center has 15 employees who will deliver safe water by improvised motorbikes known as tuk-tuks. The 20-liter cans sell for 50 cents.
The charge of the cost to the customer is actually not very high, because what we do, they can pay these into installments. We don't tell them that you have to do it that particular day. You can do it in installments until the other time you're refilling.
This new eco center hopes to serve around 3,000 residents, and plans are underway to replicate the initiative in other areas. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Oloitoktok, Kenya.
V- This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Last year, malaria sickened over 214 million people across the globe and killed some 438,000 of them. And although the disease is relatively common in tropical and subtropical regions, 90% of the deaths occurred in Africa. Most of them were children under 5 years of age. But consider that since the turn of the century, deaths from malaria have fallen by half. According to the World Health Organization, in the year 2000, 985,000 people succumbed to the disease. Today, malaria is in retreat due to a strong global push to reduce deaths and illness. More than 100 countries are now malaria-free, and another 57 cut their incidence of malaria by at least three quarters. 10 years ago, President George W. Bush founded the President's Malaria Initiative, a historic U.S. government effort to lead the fight against malaria. His successor, President Barack Obama, expanded the effort, eventually doubling its funding. Today, the initiative focuses on 19 of the hardest-hit countries in sub-Saharan Africa and three countries in Southeast Asia. Our investment has been well worth the effort. Since the launching of the President's Malaria Initiative, or PMI, led by USAID and implemented together with the CDC, overall mortality rates among children under 5 years of age have significantly decreased in the target countries, anywhere from 18% in both Liberia and Nigeria to 55% in Senegal and Zambia. Last year alone, PMI funded the spraying of the homes of over 16 million people and procured around 42 million long-lasting insecticide-treated bed nets. The United States also provided 60 million anti-malarial treatments and more than 54 million rapid diagnostic tests. In his State of the Union address in January, President Obama set forth a long-term vision of ending the disease. Noting that the end of HIV/AIDS is now within our grasp, he said, "We have the chance to accomplish the same thing with malaria." For that reason, the Obama administration requested from the U.S. Congress an extra $200 million to fight malaria worldwide, which would bring next year's total U.S. funding for prevention and treatment of the disease to $874 million. With additional funds, PMI will increase support to malaria-affected countries to further reduce malaria deaths and substantially decrease malaria illness toward the long-term goal of elimination. The United States is committed to ending this disease that prematurely ends the lives of so many people, especially children. And we call on all our partners, including non-governmental and international organizations, countries, and communities, to join our efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, television and music. Do they really have great influence on our lives? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing the influence of television and music. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.